As I pondered this text this week in between meetings and visits to the hospital and sending emails and driving around, I heard one day the voice of Alan Greenspan in my head. I can promise you this will come first. Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, was not the voice I was expecting to hear, especially in light of Paul's encouragement to rejoice in the Lord. But there they were, words that I just could not get out of my mind. Maybe you remember the words, the phrase coined by Greenspan in the midst of the dot-com boom of the 1990s, when people were going a little bit crazy in the market. He called it irrational exuberance. Listening again to Paul, I began to wonder if he was one of the first practitioners of irrational exuberance. Listen, finally, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Is that really such a good strategy for life? Just think good thoughts? I decided to try a little experiment to find out. One day this week, I waited until everyone had left the house for the day. I silenced my phone, and I got comfortable in my favorite chair. I took a few deep breaths and tried to clear my mind. The experiment was to see how long I could sit and think only about good things, about whatever is true, honorable, just, pure, pleasing, about whatever is worthy of praise. I knew this would be difficult. It would require discipline, concentration, the work of the Holy Spirit. The first thought that entered my mind, which was not wholly good and beautiful, would be the signal that the experiment was over. I said a prayer asking God to give me beautiful thoughts and settled in to contemplate all that is good in the world. I pictured the joy on my friend's face when she celebrated communion for the first time last weekend at her ordination service. I thought about the amazing lunch notes that my friend Matt makes for his daughter every day, and the good feeling I had when I heard that there were 11 volunteers from Lenshaw helping at the food pantry on Tuesday morning. I thought about the crisp fall air, the changing leaves, and the good meal that we shared with friends last Saturday night. I called to mind the saints that I have met in the course of my life and ministry. My mind began to wander, and I heard my favorite music and familiar, comforting words. And then, inevitably, I started to get restless. The experiment was over. About 3 minutes had gone by. The experiment showed me that it is hard to think about good things and only good things, to concentrate on what is good and beautiful and true without evaluating, without worrying, without being distracted, without fear. Paul understood that it was easier to think about all that is wrong with the world than all that is right with it. He knew about the temptation to hate and judge and criticize and be afraid, and so he instructs his friends in Philippi to think about things, to fill their minds with thoughts about true, honorable, pure, lovely, excellent things. Paul is not simply urging the Philippians to spend more time conducting experiments like the one I tried this last week, but he's urging them and urging us to think about goodness in the midst of life, even in the midst of trouble. And that's the key, I think. Not to retreat from the world, pretending that everything is wonderful, sheltering yourself from pain and suffering and reality, but to live fully in the world, fully alive with eyes and ears and minds attuned to what God is doing in the world. It didn't happen during my little experiment, but later in the week, another memory flashed across my mind. And taking Paul's advice to heart, I slowed down long enough for that memory to unfold and to think about what made it so good and beautiful. It was especially powerful because it had been so unexpected, so wonderfully surprising. It happened several years ago in, of all places, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. The museum itself is designed to make its visitors feel uneasy. As you enter, you are confronted by a large room made of brick and metal. There is something strangely beautiful about the place, but soon you realize that something is not quite right. They have designed the room with no right angles. You look toward the far wall and notice that the beams and bricks are just slightly off, and the floor suddenly feels slanted. The beautiful metal beams begin to look more like prison bars. After a few minutes, you start to feel uneasy, even a little sick, about what is yet to come. The museum itself begins on the fourth floor of the building. To get there, you are crowded into a small elevator. It is uncomfortable. It is meant to be. As the elevator opens, you are forced out into a stream of people. The spacious entrance has been traded for a dimly lit, narrow passage. It is quiet. Few people talk above a whisper. It is solemn and serious. The museum stirs up a whole host of emotions. You are enraged, sickened, fascinated. You want to talk to others about it, but you'd also like to get it out of your mind. As you descend deeper into the museum, you move from the beginnings of Nazi power to the ghettos and finally to the concentration camps. As you descend, you feel the weight of the reality of evil that was the Holocaust. You want to leave. You've seen enough, but the only way out is to finish the exhibit, to make it to the end. Turning the corner into the final exhibit space, you enter a large room filled with benches facing a movie screen. Survivors of the concentration camps, members of the resistance, family members, and victims are telling their stories up on the screen. You can hear their voices long before you see their faces, long before you enter the room, as you are still walking down a darkened corridor. But the voices draw you near. And people stop and sit on benches and listen to the stories, stories of great sadness and loss, but also stories of resistance and hope. Stories of hiding Jews and sending secret messages, stories of people putting their lives on the line to save a fellow human being. They were beautiful stories. Beautiful because they were not about death, but about life. Not about despair, but about hope. Beautiful because they were about love. One of the stories was about a small Protestant town in southern France named La Chambon. There, quietly, peacefully, and in full view of the Nazi-controlled French government and a nearby division of the SS, La Chambon's villagers organized to save thousands of Jewish children and adults from certain death. Looking in the museum store after our visit, I found a book that told the story of that village and its leader, Pastor André Trockmann. I was drawn to that book again this week, and as I was rereading parts of it, it occurred to me that I was finally following Paul's advice. I was occupying my mind with beautiful things, a story whose beauty stands out all the more because of the darkness that surrounds it. As the author of the book writes, the Holocaust was storm, lightning, thunder, wind, rain, and La Chambon was the rainbow. I congratulated myself for finally getting to what Paul was talking about. But then I had another thought. Was Paul telling us to think about good things all the time so that we never think about the real evil that surrounds us? Is Paul's advice an invitation to be eternally optimistic, to be irrationally exuberant, to practice the power of positive thinking? I went back again to the text, to Philippians, and started to dig a little deeper, to read it again with all of these thoughts swirling through my head. What was Paul talking about when he said to think about these things? Whatever is true and honorable, pleasing and commendable. Was he talking about contemplation or meditation, like my little experiment this week at home? After a little work, I found that a better way to express what Paul is talking about when he says to think about these things, a better way of putting it would be to take account. Paul is telling us to take account of beautiful things. Not just to fill our minds with good thoughts, but to take goodness seriously. And to not be so quick to dismiss it. So what does this all mean for us? It means, I think, taking notice of all the good things and good people we are surrounded by each day. It means taking notice of the gifts others have to offer, taking account of the ministry that happens in these walls and around town, taking account of it all and lingering there, not rushing into negativity or judgment or critique or fear. This text hit me really hard this week, because I need to hear it as much as anyone. It is easy to take things and people for granted. It's easy to focus on the problems to be solved. It's easy to get discouraged. And the antidote is not just to push those thoughts out of your mind and pretend that all is well. The answer is not to just whistle in the dark. There is work to do. Problems to fix, challenges to face. But that is not the whole story. Not in our lives, not in our families, not even here at church. Paul calls us, urges us, challenges us to train our minds to think about the presence and the work of God in our lives. Because without training, without intentionality, we won't do it, at least not for long. The cares and concerns of the world will quickly overwhelm us. Paul says not to worry, because the Lord is near. And I believe that. And I also worry, too. That's where Paul's advice comes in. It's the rest of the story. The other side of the coin. It is the thing that we need to remember and the thing we most easily forget. The Lord is near. God is never far away. And while God's presence is sometimes hard to perceive, there is a way in. There is a way to discover what God is up to in the world. And Paul says, think about these things. Take account of them. One more story to take account of. Several years ago, when Andrew and I were serving a church in McComsburg, Pennsylvania, as co-pastors, a member came into the office one day carrying an envelope. It was all folded up and dirty. She had found it attached to the front door. It was wrinkled and a folded deposit envelope from the bank next door. We opened the envelope to see if there was any sign of who I belonged to. Inside there was a handwritten letter, neatly folded into the pocket, which held $1.41. This is what the letter said. To whom it may concern. This may not seem like much, but it's all I have to give. I felt led to give this as a tithe. It was all the money I had in my pocket. Literally. But as I said, I felt led to do this. There isn't any more that I had, so I put this aside until I could deliver it onto your door. The funny thing is, I had a receipt for an item to return. I returned the item, and the change I had in my pocket was almost exactly 10% of that receipt. I have recently become unemployed and find it difficult to find where my next dollar will come from. This is 10% of all the money I have left. Please pray for me. Sincerely, on my way back. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, take account of these things. Take account, Paul says, no matter how big or small the good thing might be. Few history books remember the village of La Chambon and how goodness happened there. and that $1.41 will never be missed in the annual report. But these things did happen, however small the impact may seem. Paul tells us to take account of these things. When we take account of that village in France or the unemployed person's tithe, we make preparations for an even more beautiful experiment than the one I tried this week. As we take account of these and other beautiful things, our eyes are trained to see goodness. Our eyes are trained to see God's hand at work in the world. But why should we bother? Why should we try this experiment in the midst of our busy lives? Why should we train our eyes to notice such things? Why talk so much about taking account of the good we often neglect? To answer these questions, we must go back to Paul's invitation once again. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, take account of these things. For where do we find that which is most true and honorable and just and pure and pleasing and commendable, excellent and worthy of our praise? We find all these things and more in the God who came to us in the person of Jesus Christ, right into the messiness of human life, and lived the most beautiful life that was ever lived, a life lived for us, so that we might enjoy God forever. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God.